Historically, my past investment, most of the founders graduated from university in Singapore. And I think they have a higher advantage comparing to founders who study in the US or Europe. Because being in Singapore, you're so close to Vietnam. Most of the time, these founders worked for a Southeast Asian conglomerate or a Vietnamese conglomerate right after graduation. So immediately, they are really immersed in the local market right after graduation.
Welcome to Brave. Learn from Southeast Asia's best tech leaders. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. No BS on success. I'm Jeremy Au, venture capitalist, serial founder, Harvard MBA, science fiction nerd, and dad of two daughters. Every week, we debate startup news, interview changemakers, answer listener questions, and share personal insights. Join our movement of over 40,000 members and get transcripts, resources, and community at www.bravesea.com. Stay well and stay brave. Hey, Valerie, really excited to have you on the show. How's life for you?
Hi, Jeremy. Life is good. I just came back from Lunar New Year holiday. Yeah. For the audience who don't know, it's the biggest holiday in Vietnam. So we have actually almost 10 days, almost 2 weeks of break because the government still treats Lunar New Year as the biggest holiday. I think Singapore is quite different. You only have 2 or 3 days break.
Yeah.
But in Vietnam, we have the full holiday. And if you look at lunar calendar, until the 15th of January, people still have really like festive atmosphere and festive mood ongoing. So going back to office is not happening fully after January 15th of lunar calendar, which we already passed that. So, you know, I'm quite energetic and ready to back to the regular working schedule, ready for new year, the year of the dragon.
Yeah, it's actually interesting now that you mention it, because there is some synchronization between Singapore, Indonesia, and China. So obviously China does have that very long holiday as well. And I think I saw the news recently that it was an all-time travel high, I think higher than pre-COVID, because of China tourism going to Southeast Asia, especially like Singapore, Vietnam, because of visa-free travel as well. So they had that long two-week holiday. So it's interesting, actually, now you reminded me that Vietnam has one. Yeah, like you said, Singapore does not have one. The reason why is that, you know, there are several official religions and each one of them has the same number of holidays, you know, and Singapore is one of the least number of holidays in Southeast Asia in total number as well, because we're so productive and so pro-work. But what happens, of course, is that during the same 2 weeks is that not a lot of work gets done. So I was just rolling off a call and was just talking about how, like, you know, this year, because of the lunar calendar, is much closer to the December holidays because it was in early February. So basically, we were all kind of like complaining how nobody worked for January because Christmas holidays, then the Lunar New Year. Then now that the Lunar New Year is happening, now a ton of work is happening. Everybody's all like meeting, work, everyone's back to back. So I thought it was interesting.
And since you mentioned Chinese tourists, actually I was traveling in the Lunar New Year in Da Nang, which is an up and coming city in Vietnam, located in central Vietnam. I think they're being upgraded to tier one city. Yeah. There were a lot of foreign tourists in Da Nang, but not a lot of Chinese tourists at all. Most of them are Korean, following by Japanese tourists. But I think if we expect to see more Chinese tourists come back to Vietnam, our tourism and our economy would fare better, because pre-COVID levels, like mainland Chinese tourists account for 1/3 of foreign visitors to Vietnam. Wow. So, you know, we are missing one. The amount of Chinese tourists has not been recovered at all. And just by going around the city of Da Nang, I only see mostly Korean tourists. So I hope the number of Chinese tourists will recover in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was walking around Singapore just yesterday afternoon around Marina Bay Sands, and there were a lot of Chinese tourists. I mean, you could tell because I think the way they dress and of course what they're speaking, you can pick it up. So there are a lot of folks that are taking lots of photographs, and I thought it was great to see the crowds back, actually. I mean, it's good for Singapore. And talking about tourism, I'm excited for Taylor Swift to come in a few months' time. So quite interesting.
No, it's this coming week.
It's going to be crazy because I think Taylor Swift is spending quite a chunk of time in Singapore, and Singapore Tourism Board government basically signed an exclusivity agreement so that she wouldn't tour other cities. So I think Ed Sheeran did Thailand and Singapore, I believe. And then Taylor Swift was going to be in Singapore. And so a lot of people are going to be flying in for the tourism boom. So it's going to be quite exciting. And I was surprised because the agreement was only $2 million. So I was like, whoa, like,
that's a good deal. ROI.
I mean, it's a good deal because, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, you think about it, like $2 million to Taylor Swift, but somebody comes in, you're spending at least $2,000. And then, you know, there's like tens of thousands of attendees. And then, you know, taxing 20-30% of that via all the various expenditures.
It's a good deal because I was planning to travel to Singapore actually for work, but I have to cancel the trip because the flight ticket were insane. Vietnam Airlines totally run out of tickets. The tickets to Singapore are all sold out. I tracked a few other airlines and the tickets are like 3 times more expensive than regular price.
It's crazy. I mean, I think one of the interesting things I learned at Harvard Business School was they were talking about long tail versus blockbusters. So it's talking about the entertainment industry and how historically people thought like the internet would make people more interested in long tail content, like smaller titles, art house, because you have a library. But it turns out the internet and globalization has allowed studios to make more money on the blockbusters, like, you know, kind of like the hockey shape curve, right? That, you know, all startups want to have. But, you know, it applies for entertainment because it's zero marginal cost of consumption or production. Like if you make one Taylor Swift movie, someone else watching it doesn't incur any production costs to consume that on Netflix or whatever it is. So basically there's actually now it's even more crazy kind of like curve. So actually what's interesting, my realization I have here is like actually $2 million is cheap because Taylor Swift can pull so many people, but there are not that many Taylors, right? You know, so the question is who else is a Taylor Swift? But if you're subsidizing, I'm watching another show called Jack Johnson. He's a California kind of musician. And my wife is like, who is this guy? I'm like,
he's the guy. I don't know who that is.
Yeah, so it's a small stadium, but I'm going to go there. I don't think he got a subsidy from the Singapore government. I don't think he pulled anybody from Southeast Asia to him. So I think it's interesting to see because there's a lot of competition for the tourism dollar across Southeast Asia, for the Chinese, for Southeast Asia side. What else are you seeing on the Vietnam tourism side industry-wise?
I think other satellite, smaller tourist cities such as Nha Trang and Phu Quoc Island are also trying to pick up the pre-COVID pace of tourism. But again, because we are missing that big piece of mainland Chinese tourists who haven't actually fully come back. It's recovering, but mainly relying on the Korean tourists. The amount of Chinese tourists only recover about 30%. Pre-COVID level.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see here. And what do you think about, we talked about air quality as well in Vietnam. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, so I was so relieved in Da Nang because there was no pollution in Da Nang, right? The air quality, you can just feel so different comparing to Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh because I spent time in both Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh. And the moment you landed in Hanoi, you can just see how gloomy the sky is. And my parents keep saying that it's not from the pollution, it's actually from the weather. But I did check the IQ air and both city, Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh, have among the world worst air quality. It's like the same level with Beijing and Shanghai. And someday I actually have breathing issues. I'm glad it's gone now, but it was super terrible. I think mostly come from the manufacturing activities because both Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City are located nearby industrial hubs. And if you look at the statistic, the manufacturing output and export have been growing in Vietnam year on year and month on month. That means there's a lot of manufacturing and factory iron action right now, which is a good sign for the economy. But we can clearly see that deteriorating air quality in the major two cities is. And when I was in Da Nang, which has essentially no manufacturing activity, I can just see and feel the difference of the better air quality.
Yeah, I really like the parallel that you had in terms of manufacturing and what's happening. Let me read out some numbers. I think credit goes to Vietnam Reddit. And this guy kind of read out and said, hey, he woke up and he saw this is the quote unquote lunatic level air quality. So let me read out some numbers. He saw that number one is Dhaka, Bangladesh at 316 for the air quality index. Number two is Kolkata at 212. Then number three is Ho Chi Minh at 204. Shanghai at 198. Mumbai at 183. Number six, Delhi at 183. Number seven, Lahore, 183. Number eight, Wuhan, China. Number nine, Yangon, Myanmar. And number 10 is Hanoi, Vietnam. And then I think Chongqing and Chengdu comes at number 15, number 16. But it was quite interesting because I remember I was in China back in 2000. and 7 before the Olympics. And it was also really terrible. And then they cleaned it up a lot because of the Olympics, the Summer Olympics. Yeah. And then they basically banned all industry from operating in order to force air quality to improve. I remember people were like surprised to see a blue sky in Beijing. So actually, I was quite surprised because I saw this index and I was like, wait, basically China has cleaned up its population index somewhat, I would say. But I didn't expect Ho Chi Minh and Hanoi to be in the top 10 in the city-wise for air pollution.
Yep. Just some statistics too. Smartphone export grew 16% year on year on January 2024, Vietnam. Yeah. And Samsung factories are located in the north, like very nearby Hanoi. That's why.
Yes. The more Samsung phones you buy, the more air pollution you create in northern Vietnam.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like some random farmer is generating air quality index.
I think on top of that, in the Lunar New Year tradition, we also burn a lot of joystick. And
can't be that many joysticks. Compared to the Indonesia side, there's historically the palm oil plantations. There's the part where they burn land to renew it. And so basically what happens is that it's just easier to burn a whole chunk of land rather than to cut it down, blah, blah, blah. I think actually it makes sense. I mean, it technically creates the soot and the carbon-rich nutrients and then you replant it. Obviously, there's a lot of like deterioration from soil erosion quality-wise. But basically what happens is that Indonesia every year does have that serious air pollution problem. And then Singapore actually does have that smog problem because
the hazing, right?
Exactly, will come in from Indonesia, which is actually not good. And I think Singapore often has that air quality warning where kids can't go out and play because the smog from Indonesia is there, which is interesting. Is there any push in Vietnam to improve air quality? Because in the UK, historically, during Victorian England, they had the same problem manufacturing-wise. And then there's a public outcry, civic society, government eventually responded. I think we saw that happen in China as well, but more of a government side rather than civic society pushing to improve air quality. So is there any push by, you know, the Vietnam society for this to get better?
I haven't seen any active policy. The national television is reflecting on this issue for sure, but government hasn't really started any policy to help with the situation.
I think it's tough, right? I mean, for China, it was like moving manufacturing out, forcing manufacturers to increase the capture of all these pollutants. So it's actually quite a governmental muscle and determination to solve, honestly. I don't think it's not like a industry self-regulation piece. I don't think that's not the way forward.
And also because manufacturing is probably the most important factor on 4G growth in Vietnam this year. So I don't think there will be any measure to like, oh, you have to stop or reduce your production because it's the factor that's driving our economy forward.
So GDP first, which makes sense. Well, I mean, it makes sense from a policymaker perspective and then deal with the pollution later. I mean, that's what happened in China. That's what happened in so many emerging markets. It's not really a Vietnam issue. It's an emerging market pattern, honestly.
Talking on that, Vietnam also just launched or signed the agreement to launch a carbon credit market. So now you can buy and sell carbon credit on the market. Will it play an immediate effect? I think it will take some more time.
Yeah, I think not a priority for many emerging markets, right? I mean, I think everybody has a target and I think it's easy to sign a plan, but whether you actually push comes to shove, actually prioritize it is a question mark altogether. Now, on an interesting note in terms of manufacturing and pollution as well, I was reading this report that semiconductors, people are trying to decentralize away from Taiwan because they're concerned about geopolitical/military risk over Taiwan. And so I think that I was reading this interesting paper that basically semiconductor manufacturers are finding it easier to do it in Japan, for example, or other Asian countries like Vietnam, rather than doing it in America. Because America's actually put a lot of money into it. But it turns out because America, I think they have three major issues. One is land is corporate, so it's not owned by the government, the utilities. So it's like there's a land dynamic that's important. Two is there's a union dynamic, right? So negotiating with unions, so forth, labor standards. And then a third is actually environmental review, actually. So the US is a much more stringent environmental review process. So it turns out that Japan is much easier for all three because the government has the muscle for infrastructure and land build out. Unions are not the same level in terms of organization. I think that's also true in Vietnam and Singapore. Unions are not like the US unions as well. Now, obviously, environmental review is much more streamlined or lightweight. Or you could say underweight, I would say, compared to the US, depending on your point of view. But I thought this is interesting to see that people are basically having more success decentralizing production in Vietnam, Singapore, Japan on the semiconductor side. So in terms of other pollution for Vietnam, what do you think about that? I mean, water pollution, plastic pollution, landfill, recycling, how's that coming along?
I don't have an exact statistic, but I think the bigger problem right now is water quality because the Mekong Delta region is very crucial for like crops and agriculture in Vietnam. And recently, there were many droughts in the past few years. So I think the lack of clean waters, especially for the agricultural region of Mekong Delta, is a big issue.
Interesting. Yeah. So let's talk about the reservoir article talking about fraud, cash delivery fraud by delivery riders. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's a typical kind of problem in emerging country. I'm sure Indonesia has their fair share of fraud, especially on cash on delivery. But the overall trend, I think the article might be a bit outdated because cashless payment, especially through credit card and debit card, and now QR code are getting more and more popular than ever and getting bigger market share in terms of e-commerce transaction. And those numbers, those GMV from those transactions are actually far exceeded the cash on delivery already. So yeah. I think the article might be outdated and it's a common issue among all frontier emerging markets.
I think what's interesting is that the article was also talking about Grab and Shopee Food, which is the two competitors in the space. And it's interesting because a lot of folks don't really know that Shopee has a Shopee Food. I've never ordered from Shopee Food.
Yeah. I think Shopee Food is only available in Vietnam.
Yeah. So could you share a little bit more about what the experience is? Which one do you prefer? What's the differences between the two platforms?
I prefer Shopee Food.
Ooh, why? Is it price? Is it subsidies? I mean, there's one way they compete, or is it just a UX?
So Grab, they work mostly with big chain, kind of the brand that you're already familiar, like KFC, McDonald's. They would be always available on Grab because I believe Grab tech rate is higher than that of Shopee Food. So only big stores or restaurants who are already at scale can afford Grab. Shopee Food, on the other hand, they have a lot of like mom and pop merchants, smaller merchants, but the food quality is better, right? They are not a chain. Maybe yeah. They have one or only two locations. And I like that type of food better comparing to McDonald's or KFC or Vietnam. So that's why I order from Shopee Food more frequently than Grab.
All the product managers on both sides are listening in right now. What's interesting is that Foodpanda was trying to sell to their part of the mothership called Delivery Hero. And I think for about 2 months now, I say, you know, there was the leak that they were negotiating with Grab to potentially sell themselves. I think it goes back to the economics, right? Like food delivery is a really tough, low margin, or let's be real, a negative margin business for many platforms. And so it's a very tough business to build. And supposedly, I think economies of scale will let you consolidate some SG&A costs, give you some profitability, give you some negotiating leverage. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, Foodpanda didn't sell. And supposedly, Grab left the table. They felt like the price wasn't good enough. Perhaps maybe the public disclosure of the talks or so kind of came out as well. So I think it's interesting to see how food does. I mean, Foodpanda is not in Vietnam, but it's interesting to see how the consolidation of the food systems will come out. Are there any other food delivery services in Vietnam that's out there as well between these two?
Yeah, they are, but they leaving or already left the market. Like 2 years ago, Baemin was the third largest food delivery player. They decided to leave Vietnam Q4 2023 because, you know, it's a tough game. They need to reserve capital to the main market, which is South Korea. Right. So Baemin left Vietnam late last year. So now the few remaining players, substantial players, are Grab and Shopee Food. And you know, Shopee Food also, so Shopee acquired a food review company in Vietnam called Foodie, and they rebranded Foodie to Shopee Food. And that's why Shopee Food enjoys a more diverse selection of merchants and restaurants, especially mom and pop shop, because these mom and pop shop actually have more reviews from previous user of Foodie versus Grab. They, like I mentioned, they might have higher tech rate. I'm quite sure of that. And that's why they can only work with mostly chain and bigger merchants.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I don't think they're playing the same game, right? Which I think, like you said, I think Grab is focusing a little bit on a higher take rate. Because I think profitability from the, you know, overall group is really important for them. While, like you mentioned, for Shopee, it sounds like they're more willing to go on a growth strategy, right? More frequent orders, but maybe smaller orders. Again, speculation on my end, but based on what you're saying here.
Correct, yeah.
But ask, what's your favorite order?
Favorite order?
Yeah, what do you order all the time on Shopee?
I order the grilled pork noodle. Ooh, I will order it for you next day. Yeah, next time when you're in Vietnam, I will order it for you.
Oh, yeah. That'll be my first ever Shopee Food experience. I never had one. First time tourist. There we go. On that note, we're talking about coverage, right, of Vietnam as a country. And actually, it was interesting to see that there's been a lot more coverage of Vietnam in The Economist, actually. I feel like every issue now, there's an article in Vietnam. So we look at those articles, and I think there's several headlines. One was like, few countries are better place than Vietnam to get rich. That's one title. Another one was, Vietnam needs a new leader, was another title. So lots of different articles. I mean, also previously talk about the education system and the high quality there. But I guess you and I want to talk about what we think about the quality, I guess, of The Economist coverage for Vietnam as a market.
Yeah, I am a bit surprised by the recent articles put out by The Economist. The articles have barely any data, statistics, or actually testimonial from reliable source to prove for their point of view. So it was really one-sided point of view. I don't necessarily agree with what they are portraying in the articles. I think it's a bit unfair. I'm a bit surprised by why their title are becoming more and more like a bait, which The Economist was not known for being that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, one interesting fact is that they did move their bureau chief, right? And, you know, the person was formerly located in Hong Kong and they moved to Singapore, actually. So I think there's a big reason why I think there's a rise, I would say, in the coverage, obviously, of Southeast Asia, because I guess the bureau chief is closer to Southeast Asia. That's one piece. But also, of course, I think what's interesting is that economists, you know, I think they're quite clear about their stance, right? I think they're pro-trade. I think they're definitely, can't remember the exact phrases they use there, so I don't want to quote there. But they do have, I think, a strong, I wouldn't say, I think some people characterize it as political, but I think from their perspective, they look like they have a strong like values or normative stance, I think. On. And I think what's interesting is that it almost feels like every time I read this, it's like I'm reading this as a Southeast Asian reading historically a UK-based paper, right? That's catering to the West in some ways about a country that's very nearby, right? And I think that's also, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, whatever their stance is, I want to see a more actual stance. Statistics data report in a reliable, if they interview maybe as a politician, but they didn't. It was really objective to their point of view.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see. I mean, maybe I'm a bit more optimistic as well. I feel like, you know, maybe they're slowly progressing and learning, I think. And also, I think it's interesting because I think this is really important because when I was in the US like a month ago, the truth is most people are not getting much coverage about Southeast Asia. So The Economist is actually maybe the only real piece that actually covers it on a maybe recurring basis because they have a whole section, right, on the Asia side that's excluded. China is a separate piece and then the Asia section. So I think it's quite interesting because there's always a recurring Southeast Asia piece. Whereas I think Wall Street Journal and New York Times, you know, they're more unbundled, right, in that sense. So anyway, I just think that there's a lot of, I think they punch above their weight for The Economist. It's not just one publication, but it's actually a source of framing and thinking for a lot of folks in Washington, D.C.
Agree.
So I think last thing is that, you know, we wanted to talk about that Nikkei Asia article, which was about Harvard and Oxford graduates powering Vietnam's tech startup scene. What do you think about that?
I haven't read the article, but based on the title, I agree, but also disagree. The Harvard Oxbridge type of grads, you know, they have a lot of pedigree and prestige to their name. So it's still easier for them to fundraise and get trust from VC. But historically, my past investment, actually most of the founders graduated from university in Singapore. And I think they have a higher advantage comparing to founders who study in the US or Europe. Because being in Singapore, you're so close to Vietnam, but still get the international exposure that other founders or kind of the founders without foreign education will not have. They can make the trip to Vietnam, which is less than 2 hours monthly or at least like quarterly. So they get updated to what's happening in Vietnam more often. And sometimes, actually most of the time, these founders worked for a Southeast Asian conglomerate or a Vietnamese conglomerate right after graduation. So immediately, they are really immersed in the local market right after graduation versus the Harvard and Oxbridge type of graduate. Even though they might be Vietnamese, they are away from Vietnam for like at least four to five years, depending on how many years they study and work overseas. So when they come back to Vietnam, still take them some time to adapt and adjust back to the working culture, to the local nuances, especially working culture, how to deal with suppliers, negotiate with customers, communicate with your employees, especially. So to be honest, the majority of my founders graduated from Singapore University, such as National University of Singapore, Singapore Management University, or Nanyang Technology University. So I think the article is missing a big piece there. And it's the title sounds a bit favorable.
Yeah, I mean, it's always sexier bit, right? I mean, these days,
yeah.
I think, you know.
Yeah.
Can't really. Because I can't hate the player, you have to hate the game in that sense. But I think you raise a really great point, which is that, you know, I previously did some, you know, quantitative analysis on university education. Yeah, I think the short answer that you have there is, I think from, you know, if you look at an objective, quantitative, absolute number, I think National University of Singapore is the number one source of, you know, kind of like unicorn founders in Southeast Asia, right? So I think that's an important school because, like you said, I think National University of Singapore actually ranks very highly in terms of academic qualities, comparable to many of the top universities in the US, but also yes, the size, right? Because a lot of folks in Southeast Asia travel to NUS, et cetera. I mean, the absolute number. I think what I can say about Harvard, and I would say to a lesser extent Oxford, but I think for the Harvard and Stanford folks who are returning to Vietnam, Asia, they are also still in the top 10. So like they're like number 3, number 5, for example, like they're actually quite high in the rankings. It's just that the total absolute numbers of people who are coming back is lower. So the per capita hit rate of the founders in terms of raising large rounds and growing them. Now, whether there's a function of funders saying like, oh, you know, they're prestigious, so we'll follow that signal, versus they're actually quantitatively better at building a company versus are they quantitatively better at fundraising is to be determined. But I think that's a big part of it. I did like also the Nikkei article. They did show that Vietnam leads Southeast Asia in study abroad. So Vietnam has by far number one with about 140,000 people who study abroad. Indonesia only has about 60,000, number 2, Malaysia at 50,000, Thailand at 25,000, Philippines at also around 25,000, Singapore about 20,000, then Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, Brunei, lower than that. I'll say the good news for Singapore is that on a per capita basis, you know, it's a lot smaller than everybody else. So an absolute number. But I think Vietnam is interesting because, you know, Vietnam is smaller than Indonesia population size, but, you know, effectively has, you know, 2.5 times more people studying abroad than Indonesia. So it's quite an interesting fact, I would say.
Yeah. I think we covered this in our past episode, right? Education is really the most important thing in Vietnamese household. That's the last thing that we will sacrifice. We have to put education as the priority. I think we already discussed in previous episodes.
You know what I want to do is maybe next time we'll do a discussion, but what is there a tiger mom version or stereotype of Vietnam households? I mean, in America, they have one, they call it tiger mom. But I'm just kind of curious, you know, in the future, what we can do is like, what does a typical Vietnamese family focus on, for example, education-wise, etc. That'd be interesting to look at it that way. On that note, thank you so much, Valerie, for spending your time this morning with us.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, Brave, for having me again.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. We would also appreciate you leaving a rating or review. Head over to www.bravesea.com for member content, resources, and community. Stay well and stay brave.